As Emily read a moment ago, after Jesus died on the cross, two men named Joseph of Arimathea and Nicodemus got permission to bury his body. The Jewish Sabbath began at sundown that night, so they took his body down from the cross quickly. They anointed it with spices, they wrapped it in linens, and then they buried it in a tomb nearby. The 12 disciples were noticeably absent. They had scattered in fear because Jesus had been branded a traitor and a criminal, and who knew if the authorities were going to come after them next. In fact, sometime on Saturday, the Jewish and Roman authorities got together and they decided to put guards at Jesus' tomb. They didn't want anyone going to visit. They didn't want his disciples coming and maybe doing something with the body. They didn't want them making a martyr out of Jesus. So they sealed the tomb and placed guards there in front of it. But as Mark tells us, when the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that they might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" Now let me ask you a question. Why did the women go to the tomb on Sunday morning? Mark says that it was to anoint Jesus' body, to take these spices and anoint his body. But Joseph and Nicodemus had done that on Friday afternoon when they took the body down. And the women knew that. They were there at that moment. So why are they going to anoint his body again? Did they think maybe the guys didn't do a very good job? Did it need to be redone? What is going on? They also knew there would be Roman guards there. They would probably get some trouble if they arrived at the tomb. They knew that it was sealed. They knew that there was this huge rock in front of it, and there's no way they would be able to move it themselves, even if there was no one else there. In fact, that's what they're saying on their way. So on one level, it doesn't really make any sense why they went to the tomb that Sunday morning. But I think that's because we don't fully understand what they were probably feeling. You see, they loved Jesus. They believed in Jesus. They had left, some of them, their families and followed Jesus for years now. For some of them, Jesus had literally changed their lives. And they had come to believe that Jesus was actually going to change the entire nation of Israel. And so when he was brutally tortured and murdered, executed right in front of them, they went into deep shock and probably deep grief. And it's almost like that Sunday morning, they just needed to see his body one more time. So they went back to the tomb, and Mark tells us what they found. But when they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. And as they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in a white robe sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus the Nazarene who was crucified. He has risen. He is not here. See the place where they laid him. But go, tell his disciples and Peter, he is going ahead of you into Galilee, and there you will see him just as he told you." Now, before we read what the women did next, I need to point something out about the events that took place that Sunday morning and how they're described in all four of the books or the accounts that we have. Women are the focus of the story. And we would never expect that, because in their culture, women were not considered reliable witnesses. Sorry, ladies, but in that culture, women were not even allowed to be witnesses in a court of law. If something happened and only a woman was a witness to what had happened, their testimony was not accepted, because it was believed women are just too emotional, right? They might stretch the truth. They might tell you what they wanted to see happen, but not what actually happened. And this is really significant, because if the gospel writers were making this story up, they would have never written it this way. If the disciples were fabricating this story, if they were embellishing it, if they were trying to get people to believe something that didn't really happen, they would have never put this in the story. Describing women as the first witnesses would have made their story less believable, not more believable. See, the best explanation for why these unreliable women are the focus of the story, are the first ones to get to the tomb, are the first ones that are told Jesus is risen from the grave, are the ones who then go and tell the men about it. The best reason is because it really did happen that way. So these women are told, go tell Peter, go tell the men that Jesus is risen from the dead. And here's what they do. Mark tells us. Trembling and bewildered, the women went out and fled from the tomb. They said nothing to anyone because they were afraid. And this is how the entire book of Mark ends. It just ends right here. The women are confused. The women are afraid. And initially, at least, they don't tell anyone. Now, we know from other accounts that eventually they found the men and they did tell them what they saw or what they heard. And Luke tells us how the men responded. They did not believe the women because their words seemed to them like nonsense. Peter, however, got up and he ran to the tomb. Bending over, he saw the strips of linen lying by themselves, and he went away, wondering to himself what had happened. So the men don't believe the women. Not surprised about that, right? And then Peter, he's curious enough. He wonders, is there something going on? And so he goes and checks out the tomb, but when he gets there, it's empty, and he's still not sure what happened. He doesn't seem to believe. In fact, one of the other disciples, Thomas, will later famously say, I am not going to believe unless I can stick my fingers in the nail holes in Jesus' hands. I will not believe. In fact, the entire story of Jesus' death and then resurrection, when you look at his closest followers, they are overwhelmed by fear, confusion, and disbelief. And that is because nothing they expected to happen when they came into Jerusalem a week before actually happened the way they thought it would. None of his followers thought Jesus would be arrested. None of them thought Jesus would be crucified. And when he was, nobody believed that he would rise from the dead. Nobody had that as an option in their thinking. Nobody even had that as a category of possibility in their minds. When Jesus was crucified and pints of his blood were pouring out onto the ground, when his body was twitching and moving on the cross and he was trying to breathe and he couldn't, and then ultimately he stopped moving and he was taken down from the cross and his body grew cold and numb and it was placed and wrapped in linens and then put in a tomb, and the tomb was sealed. Nobody believed that he might rise from the dead. There was no launch party scheduled for Sunday morning. They weren't gathered around the tomb starting a countdown. There was no Easter sunrise service or Easter egg hunt planned. All of his followers that weekend were afraid, confused, and disbelieving. And that's because God was up to something that none of them could have ever imagined or fathomed. Now, later they would begin to put it all together, and then they would try to explain to others what had actually happened. But before we look at their explanation, I want to read you a passage from another story. It's called The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. Many of us know this story. It's a children's book by C.S. Lewis about four children who visit the magical world of Narnia, where they meet Aslan, the good and noble lion. But there's a wicked witch, and she has been ruling over Narnia as an evil tyrant with her evil followers, and she even tricked one of the children, Edmund, into helping her betray Aslan. If you were here for our Good Friday service, we read how Aslan gave up his life to save Edmund's. And his two sisters, Susan and Lucy, couldn't believe it. As much as they loved their brother, Edmund, why would Aslan allow himself to be killed by the witch right before their very eyes? It didn't make any sense to them. That's where we pick up the story. While the two girls still crouched in the bushes with their hands over their faces, they heard the voice of the witch calling out, "Now follow me all and we will set about what remains of this war. It will not take us long to crush the human vermin and the traitors now that the great fool, that great cat, lies dead." And at this moment, the children were for a few seconds in very great danger, for with wild cries and a noise of skirling pipes and shrill horns blowing, the whole of that vile rabble came sweeping off the hilltop and down the slope right past their hiding place. At any other time, they would have trembled with fear, but now the sadness and shame and horror of Aslan's death so filled their minds that they hardly thought of it. As soon as the woods were silent again, Susan and Lucy crept out onto the open hilltop. The moon was getting low, and the thin clouds were passing, but still they could see the shape of the lion lying dead in his bonds on the stone table. And down they both knelt in the wet grass, and they kissed his cold face, and they stroked his beautiful fur, what was left of it, and they cried till they could cry no more. See, I wonder if the women were going to the tomb that morning to simply hold Jesus' body again and cry together. At last, Lucy said, "I cannot bear to look at that horrible muzzle. I wonder if we could take it off." And so they tried, and after a lot of working at it, for their fingers were cold, and it was now the darkest part of the night, they succeeded. And when they saw his face without it, they burst out crying again. And it was all more lonely and hopeless and horrid than I know how to describe. "I wonder, could we untie him as well?" said Susan presently. But the enemies, out of pure spitefulness, they had drawn the cords so tight that the girls could make nothing of the knots. I hope no one who reads this book has been quite as miserable as Susan and Lucy were that night. But if you have been, if you've been up all night and you've cried till you have no more tears left in you, you will know that there comes in the end a sort of quietness and you feel as if nothing was ever going to happen again. See, this is how Jesus' disciples, his family, his friends, his followers, how these women felt that Sunday morning. Heartache, grief, numbness, and hopelessness. Hours and hours seemed to go by in this dead calm, and they hardly noticed that they were getting colder and colder. But at last, Lucy noticed that the sky on the east side of the hill was a little less dark than it had been an hour ago. And in the wood behind them, a bird gave a chuckling sound. It had been so still for hours and hours that it startled them. Then another bird answered it, and soon there were birds singing all over the place. It was quite definitely early morning now, not late night. "I'm so cold," said Lucy. "So am I," said Susan. "Let's walk around a bit." So they walked to the eastern edge of the hill, and they looked down. And the country looked all dark gray, but beyond, at the very end of the world, the sky began to turn red. They walked to and fro more times than they could count between the dead Aslan and the eastern ridge, trying to keep warm, and oh, how tired their legs felt. Then at last, as they stood for a moment looking out towards the sea, the red turned to gold along the line where the sea and the sky met, and very slowly up came the edge of the sun. And at that moment, they heard from behind them a loud noise, a great cracking, deafening noise, as if a giant had broken a giant's plate. "What's that?" said Lucy, clutching Susan's arm. "I feel afraid to turn around," said Susan. "Something awful is happening." But when Susan and Lucy turned to look, the rising of the sun had made everything look different. All colors and shadows were changed. That for a moment they didn't see the important thing. And then they did. The stone table was broken into two pieces by a great crack that ran down from it from end to end. And there was no Aslan. "Oh no," cried the two girls, rushing back to the table. "Oh, it's terrible," sobbed Lucy. "Couldn't they have left his body alone?" "Who's done this?" cried Susan. "What does it mean? Is it magic?" "Yes," said a great voice behind their backs. "It is more magic." And then the two girls turned around. Now, I need to tell you, the first time I read this story to my kids, they were 4, 5, and 6. And I knew that this was the culmination of the story. And so I stopped at this moment and I looked at them and I said, "When Susan and Lucy turned around, what do you think they saw?" And Marin, my youngest at the time, she looked back at me and she said, "They saw the witch." See, Marin had no idea how the story was going to turn out. She didn't know the end, and all she could think or imagine in her mind was that the witch had won. But there, shining in the sunrise, larger than they had seen him before, shaking his mane, for it had apparently grown again, stood Aslan himself. "Oh, Aslan," cried both the children, staring up at him, almost as much frightened as they were glad. "Aren't you dead?" said Lucy. "Not now," said Aslan. "But you're not a, asked Susan in a shaky voice. She couldn't bring herself to say the word ghost. Aslan stooped his golden head and he licked her forehead, and the warmth of his breath and a rich sort of smell came over her. "Do I look like a ghost?" he said. "Oh, you're real, you're real. Oh, Aslan," cried Lucy. And both the girls flung themselves upon him and they covered him with kisses. "But what does it all mean?" asked Susan. "It means," said Aslan, "that though the witch knew the deep magic, there is a magic deeper still which she did not know. Her knowledge goes back only to the dawn of time, but if she could have looked a little further back into the stillness and the darkness before time dawned, she would have read there a different incantation. She would have known that when a willing victim who had committed no treachery was killed in a traitor's stead, the stone table would crack and death itself would start working backwards." "And now," said Aslan presently, "to business. I feel that I am going to roar, so you had better put your fingers in your ears." Now, you'll have to read the rest of the story for yourself, but this is not the end of the story of Narnia. This is actually the beginning of the liberation of Narnia, the undoing of the evil and the death that the White Witch had brought about. It is the story of death itself working backwards. And I read it to you today because this is the Easter story. The stone table has cracked. The tomb is empty. Jesus is not there. He is not dead. He defeated death, and death has started working backwards. The Apostle Paul would later explain it in this way. He wrote, "If Christ has not been raised, your faith," and he's speaking to other followers of Jesus, "your faith is futile, and you are still in your sins. But Christ indeed has been raised from the dead. For as in Adam all die, so in Christ all will be made alive." See, for Paul, if Christ didn't rise from the dead, then we are still living under the reign and rule of sin. And we talked about this during this season of Lent, how our world is ruled by greed and envy and apathy and arrogance and lust and hatred and violence. They rule over our world just like the White Witch ruled over Narnia. And the rule of sin always leads to death. Not just physical death, not just death in our bodies, though that is part of it, but the death of our humanity. It's like the rule of sin sucks the life and the breath out of our lungs and out of our hearts and out of our relationships and out of our work and out of our time and our hopes and our humanity out of our lives. And Paul says it's been this way going all the way back to Adam. Under the reign and rule of sin, we all die. But Christ died himself to the reign and rule of sin. And in his death and in his resurrection, he ushered in an entirely new reign and rule of God and life. And it took a while for those first women and men to understand what God had done and what God was in the process of doing. But once they did, they began to share their message with the world, and it changed the world. And here's the message that they shared. Let me summarize it with three statements. First, that Jesus has vanquished the rule of sin and death. It happened when he died on the cross and rose from the grave. Past tense, it has happened. And if it did not happen, Paul says, you can pretty much throw everything else that we believe out the window. If it didn't happen, we are all still living in sin, under the rule and reign of sin and death. But it did happen. And all of the evidence and all of the stories and everything that took place afterwards give us full confidence to know and believe that Jesus died on the cross and he rose from the grave. And when he did, he vanquished the rule of sin and death. But second, Jesus is making us new, whole, and alive again. This is present tense. This is happening right now. Paul says, for those of us who are in Christ, and by that he means those of us who are united to Christ in his death and in his resurrection, we are no longer in sin. We're no longer under the rule of sin. And Jesus is in the process of healing us, of making us new and whole and alive again. And this is a process that takes place over the entire course of our lives as the rule of sin and death is undone, is rolled backwards. There's another great picture from The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. I wish we had time to read it. But many of the talking beasts of Narnia had been frozen as statues under the rule of the White Witch. And after Aslan rises from the dead, he goes looking for these frozen statues. And when he finds them, he breathes upon them. And his life begins to work its way into their lives. And the statues slowly come back to life. God is in the process of breathing his healing and his wholeness and his life back into our lives. But third, Jesus will destroy sin and death, finally and fully. Notice this is future tense. It has not happened yet. And though we can begin to experience healing and wholeness in our lives, we still live in a world ruled by sin and death, but not forever. God will one day destroy sin and death, finally and fully. Now, I can't explain God's timing. I can't explain his wisdom or his plans in all of this because I don't have his perspective. We just know that right now he has created this group of people called the body of Jesus that will be a witness to our world of what it's like to live not under the reign and rule of sin, but under the reign and rule of grace and life and God. And sometimes, as the body of Jesus, we do that really well, and sometimes we don't do it very well. But one day, Jesus will destroy sin and death fully and finally. And Paul says, when that happens, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. Where, O death, is your victory? Where, O death, is your sting? I want to close today by inviting you to do one of two things. If you've been a follower of Jesus for some time, maybe even a long time, would you simply just celebrate and re-embrace and proclaim these truths again today? And the easiest way to do that is just by singing really loud, right? We're in a moment going to wrap up our service by singing a couple of more songs. And I do not have a great voice. You can just ask my family. Do I have a great voice? No, I do not have a great voice. But I want to sing loud because if there was ever a day for us to sing loud, for us to celebrate that Jesus has vanquished the rule of sin and death in our lives, today is the day. So let's do that. But here's the second thing. Maybe you're new to following Jesus. Maybe you did not grow up in a church. Maybe the Bible and some of these stories are somewhat new to you. Or maybe you did grow up going to church and you're familiar with the stories, but you left that a long time ago. And you're in the process of sort of coming back and re-engaging your faith. And you've been doing that for a little while, but maybe you've never formally or intentionally said to God, I believe in the death and resurrection of Jesus. And God, you have been blowing your spirit and your life and your breath upon my life. And so I just want to pause and acknowledge what you've done. And that from here on out, I want to live under your rule and your reign. And I'm not going to do it perfectly. I certainly won't do it consistently. And there's a whole lot of transformation that still needs to take place in my life. But I am going all in with your rule and your reign. Would you consider just saying that to God today? And then, would you just tell somebody else that you said that? It can be a friend. It can be somebody in your family. It can be somebody in this community. You can come tell me that. That you can just say, I've been going through a significant season in my journey of faith. And today, I pause to mark and acknowledge who God is and what he has done for me. Would you do that today? Let me pray for all of us, and then we will sing together. Would you join me now, and actually, let's stand together. And let me pray. God, thank you that even though and even while we were living under the rule of sin and death, that you demonstrated your love for us, and that you sent your Son, Jesus, for us. Thank you for what he did on the cross. Thank you for the experience that he offers to all of us to die to that rule and to be made new and alive. And so God, I pray that you would help us to take all of the things that we carry, whether that is wounds, whether it's anxieties, whether it's fears, whether it's shame, or guilt, or things that we can't seem to overcome in our lives, or even maybe doubts or hopelessness. I pray that you would help us to bring those to you today, and that you would blow your spirit in our lives, and you would reawaken our faith and our hope. I pray all of this in your name. Amen.